making TV special.
Alice. Made with creamy butter.
And you know what that means.
It's happening. I can feel it.
Yep.
This is Orson Welles, ladies and gentlemen. Out of character, to assure you that the War of the Worlds has no further significance than as the holiday offering it was intended to be. The Mercury Theater's own radio version of dressing up in a sheet and jumping out of a bush and saying boo. Starting now, we couldn't soap all your windows and steal all your garden gates by tomorrow night, so we did the best next thing. We annihilated the world before your very ears and utterly destroyed the CBS. You will be relieved, I hope, to learn that we didn't mean it and that both institutions are still open for business. So goodbye, everybody, and remember, please, for the next day or so, the terrible lesson you learned tonight. That grinning, glowing, globular invader of your living room is an inhabitant of the pumpkin patch, and if your doorbell rings and nobody's there, that was no Martian. It's Halloween.
Tonight, the Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations coast to coast has brought you The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells, the 17th in its weekly series of dramatic broadcasts featuring Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air. Next week, we present a dramatization of three famous short stories. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
That was Orson Welles at the end of the infamous War of the Worlds broadcast, but this is just the beginning of a very special episode of Media Monarchy. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com, and I'm really glad you joined me here for the B-side of episode 97 of MediaMonarchy.com. Today being the 70th anniversary of Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater's War of the Worlds PSYOP. And we've got a lot to go over on this special B-side episode. We're going to go all through Orson Welles and War of the Worlds and the Princeton CFR PSYOP connections, psychological warfare. We're going to listen to an amazing episode of Hour of the Time with the late, great Bill Cooper. So this is going to be an epic episode of Media Monarchy. So what I have posted, what I wrote, 70th anniversary of War of the Worlds PSYOP, sequel soon? Question mark. October 30th, 2008 is the 70th anniversary of the legendary radio broadcast by Orson Welles. As a longtime radio and Welles fan, I've always been fascinated by the War of the Worlds PSYOP. And now, as we're on the edge of another new world war order, my suspicion is that we are ripe for another amazing PSYOP. But the question is, with all the technology and media that is now available and pervasive, are we more or less likely to fall for it all over again? Now, I have the entire War of the Worlds broadcast posted up for you, and if you subscribe to Media Monarchy through iTunes, you got the episode served out to you already earlier in the day. Speaking of the day, I should tell you, it's 2 in the afternoon Pacific time here in Portland, Oregon, as I come to you on Thursday, October 30th, 2008, the day before Halloween, when Orson Welles, 70 years ago, in the Mercury Theater and the Columbia Broadcasting System, created nationwide panic and helped establish the medium of radio. So this from MarketWatch and the PR Newswire. This is the party line for you. Today, October 30th, marks the 70th anniversary of War of the Worlds, the groundbreaking radio broadcast that terrified millions of Americans who thought that the fictional audio play was real and Martians were actually landing in Grover's Mill, New Jersey. The original hour-long broadcast, which aired on the eve of Halloween, October 30th, 1938, was part of CBS's Mercury Theater on the Air, directed and narrated by Orson Welles, adapted from the H.G. Wells novel The War of the Worlds, with the audio play written by Howard Koch, writer of Casablanca. It simulated a live news report of a Martian invasion with a series of realistic newscasts seeming to interrupt regularly scheduled programming. According to Ron Simon, curator of radio and television at the Parley Center for Media, said, quote, "Blurring reality and fiction so seamlessly, Orson Welles established himself as a major artist and helped to legitimize radio as an artistic medium and major force in American culture." As part of the program, a fictional CBS News reporter tracks the Martians in progress until he himself keels over. I'll spare you the recreation, and actually, William Cooper does an excellent job of it, which we'll hear in a little bit. The broadcast is said to have been heard by over 6 million people that night. According to historians, various factors contributed to the widespread reaction. Tensions were running high, leading to World War II. The convincing natural delivery of the cast, long stretches of commercial-free airplay, and only 3 disclaimers during the broadcast clarifying its fictional nature. As a result, the show ignited a reaction of fear and confusion among listeners across the country. News reports cited people fleeing their homes and police lines flooded with listeners trying to determine the validity of the Martian invasion. The broadcast, considered one of the great moments in media history, continues to live on through re-airings, live reenactments, and adaptations all over the world, introducing a new generation to the power of radio. Now, of course, there's copious amounts of links for you, my friend. So in there, of course, the Wikipedia entry, as well as the archive.org, which is where I served out the hour-long broadcast to you earlier. There's a site called RadioHeardHere.com that I believe also has the full transcript of the War of the Worlds broadcast. Interestingly enough, the next day, Orson was, I imagine, forced, or the other side is they knew exactly what they were doing, my friends. But when the outrage was so big, they, of course, pushed Orson Welles out and made him give this not really apologetic sounding apology.
I'm quite surprised that the H.G. Wells classic, which is the original for many fantasies about invasions by mythical monsters from the planet Mars, I'm extremely surprised to learn that a story which has become familiar to children through the medium of comic strips and many succeeding novels and adventure stories should have had such an immediate and profound effect upon radio listeners.
So that's Orson Welles with his weak apology for the War of the Worlds PSYOP. I haven't been able to find the complete audio of that, just a garbled up, truncated newsreel kind of version, which, interestingly enough, if you go follow that link, I believe the second part on the newsreel is about King George visiting kids in the hospital or something. Basically, it's about English royal elite scumbags visiting their subjects. Interesting juxtaposition. However, my friends, I'm going to read to you what is basically a truncated version of a talk that we're going to hear in its entirety from the late, great William Cooper of Hour of the Time radio broadcast, as well as, of course, the Mystery Babylon radio series. So later on, when we're listening to that, you'll have already heard some of these names and it'll be a little bit easier, and we'll walk you through it right now. So this originally from hourofthetime.com, and this is William Cooper writing and speaking 10 years ago on the 60th anniversary of the War of the Worlds PSYOP. The plan to create an artificial extraterrestrial threat to the Earth was first mentioned by the Marxist John Dewey, saying, quote, "Someone remarked that the best way to unite all the nations on this globe would be an attack from some other planet. In the face of such an alien enemy, people would respond with a sense of their unity of interest and purpose." And that was John Dewey in New York, 1917. This premise was tested for credibility with the CBS presentation of The War of the Worlds by Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on October 30th, 1938. At 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the evening of October 30th, the night before All Saints Day, now generally celebrated as Halloween, an estimated 6 million Americans listened to the famous Orson Welles broadcast, War of the Worlds. The broadcast described an extraterrestrial invasion from Mars. An estimated 1 million sheeple responded with sustained credulity and fear. Thousands responded with sheer panic. The broadcast was a psychological warfare experiment conducted by the Princeton Radio Project. The Rockefeller Foundation funded the project in the fall of 1937. An office of radio research was set up with Paul F. Lazarsfeld, L-A-Z-A-R-S-F-E-L-D, as director, and Frank Stanton and Hadley Cantrill, C-A-N-T-R-I-L, as associate directors. Cantrill used a special grant from the General Education Board to study the effects of the broadcast. Cantrill published the study as a book titled The Invasion from Mars, A Study in the Psychology of Panic. It contains a complete script of the broadcast, and the book is one of a series of studies sponsored by the Federal Radio Education Committee. War of the Worlds was broadcast by the Mercury Theater on the air from a microphone in a New York studio of the Columbia Broadcasting System. Council on Foreign Relations member Frank Stanton was a CBS executive. Stanton would direct Radio Free Europe later. Regarding the program's realism, Cantrill writes, quote, "The sheer dramatic excellence of the broadcast must not be overlooked. The unusual realism of the performance may be attributed to the fact that the early parts of the broadcast fell within the existing standards of judgment of the listeners. The public believed the War of the Worlds was real, thus setting the stage for the implementation of an alien threat scenario. The only problem was that the state-of-the-art of technology at the time did not allow for a believable presentation. The development of saucer-shaped, wingless, and tailless flying machines by the Germans during World War II solved the problem." And that was basically the first few paragraphs and the last few paragraphs of an article written by William Cooper. And within there, many links, as well as the complete transcript to the show that we're going to listen to in a few minutes from William Cooper. First, you can go read more about the Marxist John Dewey, and then you can read about the Princeton Radio Project. So if we jump over just to Wikipedia, the Radio Project was a social research project funded by the Rockefeller Foundation to look into the effects of mass media on society. In 1937, the Rockefeller Foundation started funding research to find the effects of new forms of mass media on society, especially radio. Several universities joined up and a headquarters was formed at the School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. The following people were involved: Paul Lazarsfeld, director of the Radio Project; Theodore Adorno, A-D-O-R-N-O, chief of the music division, and as a sidebar, rumored in the Beatle conspiracy to have written and shepherded most of their music; Hadley Cantrill, a psychologist at Princeton University's Department of Psychology; Gordon Allport, another of Lazarsfeld's assistants, went on to be the Tavistock Institute's leading representative in the United States; and finally, Frank Stanton, researcher from CBS sent to help the project, went on to be president of CBS and aforementioned Council on Foreign Relations member. Among the radio, or rather among the project's first studies, were soap operas, known as radio dramas at the time. The Princeton Radio Project also researched the 1938 Halloween broadcast of the War of the Worlds. They found out that the estimated 6 million people who heard the broadcast, 25% thought it was real. Most of the people who panicked did not think that it was an invasion from Mars that was occurring, but rather one by the Germans. It was later determined that because of the radio broadcast from the Munich crisis earlier in the year, the masses were prone to this. A third research project was that of listening habits. Because of this, a new method was developed to survey an audience. This was dubbed the Little Annie Project. The official name was the Stanton-Lazarsfeld Program Analyzer. This allowed one not only to find out if a listener liked the performance, but how they felt at any individual moment through a dial which they would turn to express their preference, positive or negative. This has since become an essential tool in focus group research. Theodore Adorno produced numerous of the effects of atomized listening which radio supported, and of which he was highly critical. However, because of profound methodological disagreements with Lazarsfeld over the use of techniques like listener surveys and Little Annie, Adorno thought both grossly simplified and ignored the degree to which expressed taste were the result of commercial marketing. Adorno left the project in 1941, presumably to go on to work on other things. We also mention the book later written by Hadley Cantrill, The Invasion from Mars, A Study in the Psychology of Panic. The entire book is up on Google Books with a link for you. And if we jump all the way down to the very bottom, we can see the back cover of the book scanned, and it writes, on Halloween night 1938, Orson Welles broadcast a radio adaptation of the H.G. Wells fantasy, The War of the Worlds. What listeners heard sounded so realistic that at least a million were frightened by the word strange creatures from Mars had landed in central New Jersey and were unleashing a deadly assault. Moving down. Originally published in 1940. This book, The Invasion from Mars, remains a classic. The broadcast provided a unique, real-life opportunity to explore why the relatively new medium of radio could have such an effect. Using a mix of research methods, Cantrill shows that the impact of the broadcast had less to do with what went out over the air than with the standards of judgment people did or did not use in evaluating what they were hearing. The book is of continuing value to those interested in communications and mass behavior. One of the critics' blurbs is quite telling. From the New York Times Book Review, April 28, 1940, quote, one of the most fascinating, illuminating, and provocative social documents that have been brought to public attention for some time. So that is The Invasion from Mars, The Psychology of Panic by Hadley Cantrill, up on Google Books and linked over for you. Now, what William Cooper ends his article with and what it goes into, and there are many dead links on the Hour of the Time website, so I tried to pull the ones that worked. I had always known that these existed, but I had never actually heard them.
Suddenly there was a threat to this world from some other species, from another planet, outside in the universe. We'd forget all of the local differences that we have between our countries. Perhaps we need some outside universal threat to make us recognize this common bond. I occasionally think how quickly our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world.
Like I said, I had always known that those existed, and Ronald Reagan popped off many times about the quote-unquote alien threat, but I'd never actually listened to them for myself, so there you go. Now, what ties this up for me and what brings this all sort of into perspective, and we've touched on this many times, whether it's called Project Bluebeam. There was a video several months ago put up by a guy named Frank Lordy, who ran a site called SalvationRevelation.com, and he made a fantastic video called Project Bluebeam, A Holographic Rapture and the Prophet's Hologram. The idea that you can use military technology, which is disclosed and known and able, to perhaps project images in the sky. You would put Allah somewhere over the Middle East, or you would put Jesus somewhere over our Midwest. An amazing psyop. Could that be possible? Is the amazing question that I think I grapple with and wonder about. And it's amazing how this all kind of ties in right now. It's Halloween. It's the anniversary of this amazing, most amazing psychological op of the 20th century, 70th anniversary of that, a massive presidential election, now mere days away, feels a time of some sort of perfect storm, and again, we hope all goes well. I guess that's the best I can put it, and that's not putting it very well. One last thing I'll say is I always remember years ago talking with a good friend of mine from back east, my man Joey. We did a lot of theater work together, We always wondered the idea of could you pull off a sort of War of the Worlds style event in the theater in the post 9/11 era. If you could pull off some sort of thing where then, you know, a stagehand comes out with a headset and tells the audience that something happens, and could never figure out a way that, of course, you know, people would have cell phones and they'd be texting to figure out, oh no, nothing really happened. But again, an interesting idea. And again, the fundamental question for me is that with all the technology and media that is now pervasive and available, are we as a people more or less likely to fall for this kind of amazing psyop again? So now, without further ado, my friends, we're going to listen to, in its entirety, it's about 56 minutes, and there will be more news after this on this B-side of episode 97 of Media Monarchy. This is William Cooper on The Hour of the Time on the amazing War of the Worlds PSYOP.
You're listening to a special presentation of The Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. At 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, on the evening of October 30th, 1938, the night before All Saints Day, now generally celebrated as Halloween, an estimated 6 million Americans listened to the famous Orson Welles broadcast, War of the Worlds, describing an invasion from Mars. An estimated 1 million people responded with sustained credulity and fear. Thousands responded with sheer panic. Some committed suicide. And in the small village of Grover's Mill, New Jersey, residents left their homes and shot holes in their city water tower, thinking that it was a Martian tripod invasion machine. The broadcast, ladies and gentlemen, was a psychological warfare experiment conducted by the Princeton Radio Project. The Rockefeller Foundation funded the project in the fall of 1937. An office of radio research was set up with Paul F. Lazarsfeld as director and Frank Stanton and Hanley Cantrill as associate directors. Cantrill used a special grant from the General Education Board to study the effects of the broadcast. Cantrill published the study as a book titled The Invasion from Mars, A Study in the Psychology of Panic. It contains a complete script of the broadcast. The book is one of a series of studies sponsored by the Federal Radio Education Committee. War of the Worlds, ladies and gentlemen, was broadcast by Mercury Theater on the air from a microphone in a New York studio of the Columbia Broadcasting System. Council on Foreign Relations member Frank Stanton was a CBS executive. Stanton would direct Radio Free Europe in later years. Regarding the program's realism, Cantrill writes, "The sheer dramatic excellence of the broadcast must not be overlooked. The unusual realism of the performance may be attributed to the fact that the early parts of the broadcast fell within the existing standards of judgment of the listeners. A few short weeks before this broadcast, millions of listeners had kept their radios tuned for the latest news from a Europe apparently about to go to war. They had learned to expect that musical programs, dramas, broadcasts of all kinds would be cut off in a serious emergency to inform our worn and eager and anxious public. A large proportion of listeners, particularly those in the lower income and educational brackets, have grown to rely more on the radio than on the newspapers for news. On this particular night, when the listener tuned to this Mercury Theater, he heard the music of Ramon Riccello and his orchestra coming from the Meridian Room in the Park Plaza Hotel of New York City. Soon after the first piece had begun, an announcer broke in. Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. This report brought the story of the first explosion on Mars. The music was resumed only to be followed by another break. Ladies and gentlemen, following on the news given in our bulletin a moment ago, the Government Meteorological Bureau has requested the large observatories of the country to keep an astronomical watch. This bulletin contains the information that a huge flaming object, believed to be a meteorite, Felony Farm in the neighborhood of Grover's Mill, New Jersey. The swing band gets in 20 seconds more, and then the invasion continues uninterruptedly. The last announcement comes from New York City, and the announcer says, "I'm speaking from the roof of Broadcasting Building, New York City. The bells you hear are ringing to warn people to evacuate the city as the Martians approach. Estimated in last 2 hours, 3 million people have moved out along the roads to the north. Hutchinson River Parkway still kept open for motor traffic. Avoid bridges to Long Island, hopelessly jammed. All communication with Jersey Shore closed 10 minutes ago. No more defenses. Our army wiped out. Artillery, Air Force, everything wiped out. This May, the last broadcast, will stay here to the end. People are holding service below us in the cathedral. And in the background, ladies and gentlemen, you can hear voices singing hymns. Now I look down the harbor, all manner of boats overloaded with fleeing population, pulling out from docks. Then you can hear the sound of boat whistles. Streets are all jammed, noise and crowds like New Year's Eve in city. Wait a minute, enemy now in sight above the Palisades. 5 great machines. First one is crossing the river. I can see it from here, wading the Hudson like a man wading through a brook. A bulletin's handed to me. Martian cylinders are falling all over the country. One outside Buffalo, one in Chicago, St. Louis, seem to be timed and spaced. Now the first machine reaches the shore. He stands, watching, looking over the city. His steel, cowlish head is even with the skyscrapers. He waits for the others. They rise like a line of new towers on the city's west side. Now they're lifting their metal hands. This is the end now. Smoke comes out, black smoke drifting over the city. People in the streets see it now. They're running towards the East River, thousands of them dropping in like rats. Now the smoke's spreading faster. It's reached Times Square. People trying to run away from it, but it's no use. They're falling like flies. Now the smoke's crossing 6th Avenue, 5th Avenue, 100 yards away. It's 50 feet. The announcer breaks off, and the field artillery radio operator is heard. 2X2L calling CQ. 2X2L calling CQ. 2X2L calling CQ. New York. Isn't there anyone on the air? Isn't there anyone? 2X2L. And then, that's the middle break of the broadcast. The double Roman numeral X, which stands for the number 20, X times 2, are 2X, ladies and gentlemen, are espionage code names for a double cross. The fictitious call letters can be interpreted by insiders in the intelligence community to mean double cross to hell. 2X2L, double cross to hell. Hadley Cantrill was born in Hiram, Utah on the 16th of June in 1906. He graduated Dartmouth College with a Bachelor of Science in Psychology in 1928. He studied in Munich and Berlin, 1929 to 1930. He received a Ph.D. in psychology from Harvard in 1931. In 1949, Cantrill received an LL.D. doctorate in law from Washington and Lee University. Cantrill taught sociology at Dartmouth College from 1931 to 1932 and psychology at Harvard from 1932 to 1935, and Columbia University, 1935-36. In 1936, ladies and gentlemen, Cantrill joined the Princeton Psychology Department. He remained a member of the department until his death in 1969. In 1950, Cantrill authored a book called Tensions That Cause Wars. Copyright 1950. In 1935, George Gallup of Gallup Poll fame, Elmer Roper and Archibald Crosley were studying opinion polling as a tool to help social scientists and psychologists learn about people's likes and dislikes. Gallup's and Roper's surveys appeared in Fortune magazine. After the war, Harry Truman would choose the director of Fortune magazine, Council on Foreign Relations member John Kenneth Galbraith to direct European Economic Security Policy. Roper would become deputy director for the Office of Strategic Services, known as the OSS, the precursor to the Central Intelligence Agency. The OSS Psychological Warfare Division staff included Council on Foreign Relations members Douglas Cater of the Aspen Institute, W. Phillips Davison of the Rand and Columbia think tanks, William Langer of Stanford University, and William S. Paley, who was the head of Columbia Broadcasting System, known to you as CBS. Gallup's, Roper's, and Crosley's work interested people in government, aspiring politicians, and market researchers. Gallup, Roper, and Crosley were not members of the academic fraternity. Established social scientists belittled their work. However, the studies interested Cantrill. One of Cantrill's earliest articles, The Social Psychology of Everyday Life, 1934, contained a plea for social psychologists to devote more attention to devising new techniques to study ongoing problems. Lester Markell, Sunday editor of the New York Times, asked Cantrill to write some articles about scientific polling in connection with the presidential campaign of 1936. Well, folks, Cantrill went to Princeton to talk with George Gallup. Gallup was flattered and offered Cantrill the use of his facilities at Princeton to conduct the research. In 1936, Cantrill and DeWitt Poole founded a quarterly publication called Public Opinion Quarterly. Harwood Childs was editor. Cantrill was associate editor. Poole was a State Department expert in anti-communist propaganda. Poole became chief of the Foreign Nationalities Branch of the Office of Strategic Services. Poole directed OSS efforts to recruit agents from immigrant communities. The agents spied on their neighbors and analyzed foreign language publications. The Public Opinion Quarterly Board of Editors included veteran psychological warfare experts Harold Laswell, Paul Lazarsfeld, and Frank Stanton. I believe that's Paul Lazarsfeld and Frank Stanton. DeWitt Poole would become president of the National Committee for a Free Europe, one of the CIA's largest single propaganda efforts. Council on Foreign Relations member Stanton directed the Free Europe Fund, a Central Intelligence Agency proprietary corporation that laundered the money for Poole's National Committee psycho-political operations. Today, ladies and gentlemen, the Advisory Committee on Communication at Columbia University sponsors and publishes the Quarterly, the organ of Columbia University's American Association for Public Opinion Research. In 1984, CFR member Frederick T.C. Yu was on the Advisory Committee on Communication, and CFR member Daniel Yankelevich was on the editorial board of the Public Opinion Quarterly. The American Association for Public Opinion Research was founded in 1947. Its address is a post office box in Ann Arbor, Michigan. In 1993, the organization had 1,450 members and an annual budget of $170,000. It consists of six regional groups. Its members are described as individuals interested in the methods and applications of public opinion and social research. It still publishes the Public Opinion Quarterly. Cantrill's published his research on Gallup's techniques in early issues of the Public Opinion Quarterly. The articles described how to better understand why people of various backgrounds, interests, loyalties, and information levels held certain opinions, and how to use this information to effectively gear research concerned with psychological and political dynamics of people into United States government operation to achieve policy aims. In effect, ladies and gentlemen, how to manipulate people to get them to do what you want them to do. In 1940, the Rockefeller Foundation funded Cantrill's establishment of the Office of Public Opinion Research. It was housed in the attic of Princeton University's Palmer Physics Building. Its purposes were, 1, to learn and study public opinion techniques systematically. 2, to gain insights into the psychological aspects of public opinion, how and why it changes, what motivates large segments of the public. 3, to build up an archive of public opinion data for the use of qualified scholars, and 4, to begin to follow the course of American public opinion during the war that had already started in Europe. The Office of Public Opinion Research also analyzed the effectiveness of Office of Strategic Service psychopolitical operations. OSS Deputy Director Elmer Roper established a similar research center at Williams College. Dr. Philip K. Hastings, one of Cantrill's former students, directed the Roper Center. The Roper Center received all of the Office of Public Opinion Research Center's files to help them get started. Now, Cantrill coined a term for this work. He called it policy research. Cantrill tells us, "Most relevant to the story of policy research are the efforts begun in 1940 by the Office of Public Opinion Research to utilize and adapt survey methods as the European war progressed and the United States became increasingly involved. This research dealt with three kinds of problems. 1, devising questions that would help us to understand more clearly what the American people felt the United States should do vis-a-vis the war in Europe, and what differences of opinion there were in various population groups. 2, formulating trend questions that could be repeated, either at regular intervals or as events dictated, and 3, testing the reliability of small samples. During 1940 and 1941, the Office of Public Opinion Research obtained all data through the American Institute of Public Opinion at cost. On September the 12th, 1939, the Council on Foreign Relations began to take control of the Department of State. On that day, Hamilton Fish Armstrong, editor of Foreign Affairs, and Walter H. Mallory, executive director of the Council on Foreign Relations, paid a visit to the State Department. The Council proposed forming groups of experts to proceed with research in the general areas of security, armament, economic, political, and territorial problems. The State Department accepted the proposal. The project, 1939 to 1945, was called Council on Foreign Relations War and Peace Studies. Hamilton Fish Armstrong was executive director. In February 1941, the CFR officially became part of the State Department. The Department of State established the Division of Special Research. It was organized just like the Council on Foreign Relations War and Peace Studies project. It was divided into economic, political, territorial, and security sections. The research secretaries serving with the council groups were hired by the State Department to work in this new division. These men also were permitted to continue serving as research secretaries to their respective council groups. Leo Pazvolsky was appointed director of research. In 1942, the relationship between the Department of State and the Council on Foreign Relations strengthened again. The department organized an advisory committee on post-war foreign policies. The chairman was Secretary Cordell Hull, the vice chairman, Undersecretary Sumner Wells. Dr. Leo Pazvolsky, director of the Division of Special Research, was appointed executive officer. Several experts were brought in from outside the department. The outside experts were Council on Foreign Relations, War and Peace Studies members, Hamilton Fish Armstrong, Isaiah Bowman, Benjamin V. Cohen, Norman H. Davis, and James T. Shotwell. In total, ladies and gentlemen, there were 362 meetings of the War and Peace Studies group. The meetings were held at Council on Foreign Relations headquarters, the Harold Pratt House, 58 East 68th Street, New York City. The Council's wartime work was confidential. The Pratt House. The Harold Pratt House. The name Pratt is found in use as a byname in 11th century England. Pratt, ladies and gentlemen, was the English nickname for a cunning trickster. Pratt comes from the Old English word "proet," meaning trick. Pratt is the family name of the Marquesses and Earls Camden. They are descended from John Pratt, died in 1573, of Devonshire. The first Earl, Sir Charles Pratt, 1714 to 1794, was a childhood friend of William Pitt, 1708 to 1778, the first Earl of Chatham. Remember that, Chatham. England's Royal Institute of International Affairs headquarters is Chatham House, located at 10 St. James Square in London. In June of 1940, William Stevenson of British Intelligence was setting up the British Security Coordination Group in the United States. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was preparing to send an unofficial observer to London. The president selected a man he had known for more than 30 years. His name was William J. Donovan. Stevenson's mission included influencing high-ranking government officials to bring the United States into the war. Joseph P. Kennedy was the United States ambassador in London. Kennedy had been advising the president against American involvement in the war. William Stevenson was pleased when the president's choice was Donovan for the mission. Donovan attended Columbia Law School with Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Donovan was a World War I Medal of Honor winner. In 1929, Donovan was a Wall Street lawyer. In 1935, Donovan went to Rome, Egypt, and Ethiopia for the War Department to observe the Italian campaign against Ethiopia. In 1937, Donovan attended maneuvers of the German army and inspected their tanks and artillery. In 1938, Donovan toured Czechoslovakia, the Balkans, and Italy, and visited the battlefields of the Spanish Civil War. Ladies and gentlemen, William J. Donovan was a member of the Knights Templar. In 1941, a new agency was created, the Office of Coordinator of Information. Donovan ran it. The agency pooled information gathered by all the intelligence services and used the information for psychological warfare purposes. The talents of psychoanalysis across the country were mobilized to study domestic morale and psychological warfare techniques on morale. The study was released as a top secret psychological report in 1943. It included a study of Adolf Hitler and his influence on the German people. The psychologist leading the study was Dr. Walter Langer. Walter's brother William helped to evaluate Hitler. CFR member William L. Langer was OSS branch chief for research and analysis. He worked with CFR member William H. Jackson. Their OSS research included indirect assessment. Indirect assessment, ladies and gentlemen, was a way of evaluating a man's personality or state of mind without direct interview by a psychologist. William Langer used the technique to produce a psychological profile of Hitler as part of Donovan's top secret OSS study. William L. Langer was a key figure in the intelligence community. William Langer, Alan W. Dulles, and Arthur Sweetster were members of the Council on Foreign Relations. They were specifically members of the Peace and Aims Group. Arthur Sweetster became the deputy director of the Office of War Information. Sweetster and Langer also worked together as members of the political group with John Foster Dulles, Alan's brother. General Donovan and Alan Dulles made a career of trying to have the Director of Central Intelligence assigned to the Office of the President. Now, in his early career, William Langer was a fellow at the Center for Advanced Study in Behavioral Sciences at Stanford. In World War I, Langer rose from private to sergeant and participated in the St. Mihiel and Argonne engagements. Langer's first significant book was The Diplomacy of Imperialism, 1935. Langer was a member of the Board of Analysts, Office of Coordinator of Information from 1941 to 1942. Chief of OSS Research and Analysis Branch, 1942 to 1945. Special Assistant for Intelligence Analysis to the Secretary of State, 1946. And Assistant Director of the Central Intelligence Agency, 1950 to 1952. After 1952, Langer served as a consultant to the Central Intelligence Agency. In his presidential address to the American Historical Association in 1957, Langer emphasized the need for deeper study and more extensive reference by historians to the teachings of modern psychology. William L. Langer was one of 10 editorial sponsors of the American edition of Mein Kampf. written in 1939. His view was that Hitler's Mein Kampf was an extraordinary medley of amateur politics and amazing insights into international problems and possibilities, and that Hitler showed reckless courage in realizing the German dreams, nightmarish as some of them were. In Schuster was another Mein Kampf editorial sponsor. Like Langer, Schuster was a Council on Foreign Relations, Peace, and Aims Group member. Schuster also was a journalist. He served in France as a sergeant in Army Intelligence in World War I. After the war, he was in the Army of Occupation in Germany. Schuster admired the German culture and sympathized with Germany's economic problems. In his book, The Germans, 1932, he glibly dismissed the ideas of Adolf Hitler as no more commendable for wisdom or practicable than are the notions of the average United States senator. Schuster's views towards Hitler changed. In 1934, Schuster denounced the Nazis' assaults on individual and religious freedom. During World War II, Schuster served on the enemy alien board. When the war began, Secretary of War Henry Stimson ordered an evacuation of all Japanese, alien and American alike, from the coastal regions of California. CFR member Stimson remarked that the evacuation made an awful hole in the Constitution, but he had to do it on the grounds of safety of the nation and out of military necessity. The Japanese, alien and American alike, were rationalized into concentration camps. Stimson didn't rationalize Germans, alien and American alike, into concentration camps. Did the Japanese-American evacuation recommendation come from the enemy alien board? Mein Kampf's editorial preface warns, Mein Kampf is a propagandistic essay by a violent partisan. As such, it often warps historical truth and sometimes ignores it completely. We have therefore felt it our duty to accompany the text with factual information which constitutes an extensive critique of the original. No American would like to assume responsibility for giving the public a text which, if not tested in the light of diligent inquiry, might convey the impression that Hitler was writing history rather than propaganda. Mein Kampf's editorial introduction informs us historical truth was ignored completely for over 14 years. Quote, until now, the only version of Mein Kampf in English has been a condensation of the complete book published in 1933 under the title My Battle, prepared by E.T.S. Dugdale in England, containing less than half the total text. There are undoubtedly passages of great importance which now appear in English for the first time. For example, Chapter 5 of the condensed version left out the whole of what Hitler describes as his wartime reflections on propaganda and the methods for fighting Marxism. We have marked at various points in the text the important new material. Furthermore, any abridgment must necessarily fail in proportion to the degree of its condensation. To give the full flavor of the author's mind, even the repetitions have their significance in conveying a sense of the character behind them. Mein Kampf is, above all, a book of feeling. The translation here offered is from the first German edition, the two volumes, respectively, of 1925 and 1927, which are now quite difficult to obtain, end quote. The National Socialist German Workers' Party was founded on November 9, 1919. Hitler writes in the conclusion to Mein Kampf, on November 9, 1923, in the fourth year of its existence, the National Socialist German Workers' Party was dissolved and forbidden throughout the entire territory of the Reich. Today, in November of 1926, it stands again before us free through the whole Reich, stronger and internally more stable than ever before. The German people recognized the evil of Hitler and tried to do something about it. But it didn't work. Were World War I British and American intelligence agents left in Germany as part of an Institute of International Affairs plan to cause a Second World War? Did CFR intelligence agents help bring Hitler to power to create an enemy the American people could hate, loathe, and fight? were CFR members Schuster, who wrote about Hitler in 1932, and Langer, who worked on a psychological profile of Hitler, and CFR insider Hadley Cantrell, who studied in Munich and Berlin from 1929 to 1930, three of those intelligence agents. Mein Kampf was published in 1925. Why wasn't a translation made available to the English-speaking people until 1939, and then contained only half the original text? Was this information withheld for 14 years so the Germans wouldn't receive support from other nations and Hitler could take power? Why weren't covert operations carried out to prevent Hitler's rise to power? Did the Office of Strategic Services put up funds for getting Mein Kampf translated, published, and marketed in the United States? Was Mein Kampf released in 1939 to help set the stage for ensuring America's entry into the war? Dumbarton Oaks in Georgetown is famous for being the site of the 1944 conference that led to the establishment of the United Nations. Present at the Dumbarton Oaks Conference were many members of the Council on Foreign Relations, War, and Peace Studies. Among those who had leading roles on many of the committees and commissions were George N. Schuster, William L. Langer, Arthur Sweetser, Hamilton Fish Armstrong, John Foster Dulles, Grayson Kirk, Dwight E. Lee, Isaiah Bowman, David N. Rowe, Winfield W. Riefler, Carter Goodrich, Calvin B. Hoover, Owen Lattimore, and Frank R. McCoy. Now, folks, many of these men attended the conference as members of our advisors to the State Department. 49 days later, the Council on Foreign Relations, Institutes of International Affairs, and Institutes of Pacific Relations achieved the aim they failed to achieve a quarter of a century before. At noon on 9th of October 1944, the text of the proposals the United States, United Kingdom, Soviet Union, and China agreed upon were issued simultaneously in Washington, London, Moscow, and Chongqing. The machinery to create one world government became a reality. Instead of being called the League of Nations, the organization was called the United Nations. This time, the American people weren't given the chance to say no. Today, American soldiers are part of a worldwide police force, forced to fight in times of peace wearing non-American uniforms under the command of foreign officers. Their commander-in-chief is a draft-dodging, adulterous Council on Foreign Relations member who is a chronic liar and is about to sell United States nuclear technology to Communist China's president. Institute of Pacific Relations member Jiang Zemin, the butcher of Beijing, while keeping America in a state of perpetual national security due to the threat of nuclear terrorism. Now, sometime in 1942, the Office of Coordinator of Information was reorganized into two independent agencies, the Office of Strategic Services and the Office of War Information, known as OWI. William Donovan became the head of the newly created Office of Strategic Services. William Stevenson was head of the British intelligence counterpart. The psychological warfare study was moved into the domain of the Office of War Information. In a book entitled Unwritten Treaty, James P. Warburg writes, "This book is dedicated to the men and women of OWI, who served at home and abroad on the far-flung psychological battlefronts of World War II, and whose skill and devotion created the voice of America," Warburg explains. "Psychological warfare against a declared or undeclared enemy is probably as old as human history. It consists of two basic elements, the threat or appeal to fear, and the bribe or appeal to greed. When the earliest savage raised his fist against a neighbor, he was using the psychological weapon of the threat. When he baited a trap, he was exploiting the appeal to greed. Bluff, bribery, and deception have played a part in every human struggle throughout history. But it remained for our generation to develop psychological warfare as a means of systematic nationalistic aggression. Psychological warfare aims at the undermining of a people's confidence in its cause, its strength, its leaders, and itself, and at the destruction of its determination to fight for its cause or even for its life. This combination of confidence and determination we call morale. When a nation's morale is destroyed, it commits suicide, as did Austria, or else it submits to conquest after feeble and disorganized resistance, as did France. In any case, it reaches a state of mind in which resistance seems hopeless and surrender less of an evil than endurance of armed conflict. Psychological warfare against an enemy nation seeks to paralyze the will of that nation by spreading confusion, by alternating excessive hope and excessive fear, by exploiting every cleavage and adding fuel to every prejudice. Its chief weapon is propaganda. That is the dissemination of ideas. But propaganda, to be effective, must be based upon full and carefully analyzed intelligence concerning the enemy, and must be coordinated with espionage, fifth column activity, and actual sabotage. All these assignments are carried out by the implantation of carefully selected ideas and concepts. These ideas and concepts are neither necessarily true nor necessarily false. In fact, whether they are true or false makes no difference whatsoever so long as they successfully serve to create the desired state of mind. It follows that there is no validity whatsoever to the widely held belief that propaganda consists by definition of spreading of lies. Truth and falsehood make no difference in themselves. There is equally little justification for the belief that the propaganda of decent, democratic nations should be the truth and nothing but the truth. It cannot be stated with sufficient emphasis that information is one thing, propaganda quite another. The purpose of spreading information is to promote the functioning of man's reason. The purpose of propaganda is to mobilize certain of man's emotions in such a way that they will dominate his reason. The function of an information agency is to disseminate truth to a make available fact and opinion, each carefully labeled and separated from the other. The aim of an information agency is to enable as many people as possible to form their own individual judgments on the basis of relevant facts and authoritative opinion. The function of a propaganda agency is almost the exact opposite. It is not to inform, but to persuade. In order to persuade, it must disseminate only such facts, such opinion, and such fiction masquerading as fact as will serve to make people act, or fail to act, in the desired way. The Office of Coordinator of Information and the Office of War Information weren't information agencies, they were propaganda agencies. The Office of War Information extended contracts for communications research to Paul Sarsfeld, Hadley Cantrill, the Council on Foreign Relations member Frank Stanton. The famous Orson Welles War of the Worlds was an experiment in psychological warfare. The American public became unwitting subjects in an experiment to study mass behavior to try to determine the factors of personality, experience, and circumstance that made for various degrees of suggestibility under the impact of fear. The experiment in terror was planned, coordinated, and carried out by Council on Foreign Relations members and insiders. Isn't an experiment of this nature immoral and illegal? And if they were doing that then, what, pray tell, are they doing now? Adolf Hitler and his propaganda minister, Joseph Goebbels, warped history by ignoring it completely and stressing favorable and unfavorable truths to cause tension and hate between different groups of people. Goebbels' work fascinated CFR member Edward R. Murrow. The Rockefeller Foundation funded Murrow to perform a systematic analysis of Nazi radio propaganda techniques and the political use of radio. Murrow, with help from Cantrill and Lloyd Free, began the project at Princeton in 1940. The Princeton Listening Center was set up in an old house on Alexander Street, belonging to Princeton's Institute of Advanced Study, known as the IASP. IASP was a reasonable copy of the Royal Institute of International Affairs' chief Oxford headquarters, All Souls College. CFR member Abraham Flexner of Rockefeller's General Education Board and Foundation Administrator organized it from plans drawn by Tom Jones, one of the Royal Institute of International Affairs' most active intriguers and the Foundation's administrators. This project resulted in a worldwide monitoring and broadcasting government agency called the Foreign Broadcast Intelligence Service, known as FBIS. FBIS was a psychological warfare machine. FBIS became the United States Information Agency, or USIA. The USIA was established to achieve United States foreign policy by influencing public attitude at home and abroad using psycho-political policy strategies. The USIA Office of Research and Reference Service prepares data on psychological factors and propaganda problems considered by the Policy Planning Board in formulating psycho-political information policies for the National Security Council. Edward R. Murrow would subsequently be named head of the USIA. Murrow became the propaganda minister for the United States. In effect, America's Joseph Goebbels. Was Hitler's rise to power a psycho-political operation planned and coordinated by members of the Council on Foreign Relations, Institutes of International Affairs, and Institutes of Pacific Relations? Was Hitler's rise to power another double cross to hell? Another Council on Foreign Relations experiment in fear? And if it was, and ladies and gentlemen, I know absolutely that it was, for they needed a terrible world war to propel the world into a world government under a United Nations. And isn't that treason? People's actions, ladies and gentlemen, even yours, are strongly influenced by their knowledge base. You see, people act upon their beliefs, not facts, but upon their beliefs. You see, you can manipulate a person's actions by corrupting their knowledge base, by warping historical truth or ignoring it completely. Knowledge can make for independence if it helps people meet their world more confidently and realistically, but that can only happen when people are dealing with facts and with the truth. Those who have wanted others to remain dependent have always recognized this fact and have opposed the spread of knowledge. They include those who felt the Bible must not be read by the people, those who made laws against teaching slaves to read and write, and those who kept the plans of a monster like Hitler a secret for more than 14 years. Don't you think it's time to investigate the Council on Foreign Relations, the Institutes of International Affairs, and the Institutes of Pacific Relations? And yes, even Art Bell. You see, the alien threat is presented through the use of secret technology originally developed by the Germans in their secret weapons programs during World War II, by geniuses like Nikola Tesla and many others. Most military and government personnel who have access to this material believe the threat is real. None of them, not even one, however, has ever seen any evidence of the existence of any extraterrestrial creature or any advanced technology other than that of human origin. It is extremely difficult, if not almost impossible, to believe that top secret documentation could be lied. I know. I had one of the highest security clearances that can be held by anyone, and I had access to all of this information, and what I am telling you is the truth. It is trust in government by good men and women who have given their lives in its service that keeps the real secret from the public eye. And the real secret is that there are no extraterrestrials, ladies and gentlemen. There is, absolutely is, a lot of advanced technology, mind control projects, and psychological operations. All so-called leaks are intentional misinformation projects designed to promote the alien threat scenario while allowing for complete deniability on the part of the government. The antics of Vicky Cooper Ecker, who is a CIA operative, Donald Francis Ecker III, who is just a dude, William Moore, Jamie Chanderet, Stanton T. Friedman, Bruce Maccabee, who works for the Central Intelligence Agency and the Office of Naval Intelligence, Barry Taft, who is a neuropsychiatric institute of the University of California in Los Angeles, and he works with Dr. Jolyon West, Whitley Strieber, Bud Hopkins, who is a member of the Central Intelligence Agency, John Lear, who is a member of the Central Intelligence Agency, Linda Moulton Howe, who is a member of the Order of the Eastern Star, Art Bell, who is admitted Freemason and a fellow traveler, Glenn Campbell, George Knapp, who is also a Freemason, Colonel Philip Corsa, a CIA operative who has just recently died, Richard Hoagland, the so-called alien autopsy film, The Face on Mars, which is not there, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, the so-called Mars meteorite, which supposedly contains fossil evidence of life on Mars, but does not at all contain any such evidence, the War of the Worlds, presented by the Mercury Theater on the air, and many other people and events are all projects of this type. Some, very few, however, of these people are unwitting accomplices in the charade and truly believe in the extraterrestrial threat. Most of those whom I have just named, and many others not named, however, are active and with full knowledge agents of Illuminism and socialism. The most well-known are active fellow travelers, communist agents of the KGB, the Central Intelligence Agency, are one of the many psychological warfare agencies founded by the Rhodes Roundtable Group, known as the Group, the Royal Institute of International Affairs, and the Council on Foreign Relations. The plan, ladies and gentlemen, to create an artificial alien threat to the Earth was first mentioned by the Marxist John Dewey, who is also the founder of our failing educational system. He said, quote, "Someone remarked that the best way to unite all the nations on this globe would be an attack from some other planet. In the face of such an alien enemy, people would respond with a sense of their unity of interest and purpose." He said that, ladies and gentlemen, at a dinner in New York in 1917. That's right. You heard it right, folks. 1917. The premise was tested for credibility with the CBS presentation of War of the Worlds by Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on October 30th, 1938. The public believed the War of the Worlds was an actual news broadcast, thus setting the stage for the implementation of an alien threat scenario. The only problem, ladies and gentlemen, was that the state of the art of technology at that time did not allow for a believable presentation. But the development of saucer-shaped wingless and tailless flying machines by the Germans during World War II, the implementation of psychological warfare against the sheeple of the world, and the continued development of secret technology under black projects classified and compartmentalized so that not even anyone in the Congress can ever know what it is that these people have solved the problem. President Ronald Reagan said this in a speech made to the 42nd General Assembly of the United Nations on September the 21st, 1987, and I quote, "In our obsession with antagonisms of the moment, we often forget how much unites all the members of humanity. Perhaps we need some outside universal threat to make us realize this common bond. I occasionally think how quickly our differences would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world." He inserted that paragraph in 8 speeches during his time as president. We obtained this CIA document through the Freedom of Information Act and through court battles. It's on Central Intelligence Agency letterhead, and it's from the Office of the Director. 2, the Director Psychological Strategy Board, subject flying saucers. 1. I am today transmitting to the National Security Council a proposal, Tab A, in which it is concluded that the problems connected with unidentified flying objects appear to have implications for psychological warfare as well as for intelligence and operations. 2. The background for this view is presented in some detail in Tab B. 3. I suggest that we discuss at an early board meeting the possible offensive or defensive utilization of these phenomena for psychological warfare purposes. Signed, Walter B. Smith, Director. The announcement of the Jewish Holocaust, the proposal of a world government which would prevent future genocide or wars by the formation of a United Nations in 1945, and the announcement of sightings of flying saucers by Kenneth Arnold, an ex-intelligence officer, in 1947, launched the deception. The natural guilt harbored by the men of the 509th Atomic Bomb Wing stationed just outside Roswell, New Mexico, after the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki made them eager conspirators in orchestrating the faked crash of an extraterrestrial craft and the discovery of shaved and surgically altered monkeys near Roswell, New Mexico. The artificial extraterrestrial threat was thus implanted in the minds of the public. And we recently obtained an FBI document through the Freedom of Information Act and through many court battles. From the FBI, Dallas, Director and Senior Agent in Charge, Cincinnati, flying disc information concerning, and then it's blacked out, headquarters, 8th Air Force, telephonically advised this office that an object purporting to be a flying disc was recovered near Roswell, New Mexico this day. The disc is hexagonal in shape and was suspended from a balloon by cable, which balloon was approximately 20 feet in diameter. The next word or words are blacked out. Further advised that the object found resembles a high-altitude weather balloon with a radar reflector, but that telephonic conversation between their office and Wright Field had not, and the next two words are blacked out, borne out this belief. Disc and balloon being transported to Wright Field by special plane for examination. Information provided this office because of national interest in case. And fact that National Broadcasting Company, Associated Press, and others attempting to break story of location of disc today. Two words blacked out. Advised would request Wright Field to advise Cincinnati office results of examination. No further investigation being conducted. And then there are some further lines blacked out on the bottom. Ladies and gentlemen, applying Hitler's concept of the big lie, the artificial extraterrestrial threat was nurtured and built into an always-present possibility over the next 50 years. Utilizing the psychological machine of the United States government and the intelligence community, and the partnership built between the Department of Defense and Hollywood during World War II. Eventually, a large percentage of the world's population found themselves believing in alien ships, extraterrestrial visitation, alien mutilation of animals, and alien abductions of humans with absolutely, and listen to me closely, absolutely no proof that extraterrestrials exist anywhere in the universe, much less that any have ever visited this planet. The artificial threat is further advanced through the mind control programming of Marxists and communists in Hollywood, radio, television, advertising, publishing houses, and the ufology movement, all of which are in the complete control of the Illuminati and the intelligence community. Fear is instilled through the incidental use of terror, inspired by the cattle and animal mutilation byproducts of the government's secret low-level radiation monitoring operations, and the so-called alien abduction scenario induced by state-of-the-art and extremely sophisticated mind control operations. Wake up, America, you've been had.
That he picked up the voice of the shuttle pilot, Colonel Blaha, speaking on a secret
NASA channel.
Houston, this is Discovery. We still have the alien spacecraft under observance.
NASA maintains that this is not Colonel Blaha's voice.
We annihilated the world before your very ears and utterly destroyed the CBS. You will be relieved.
attention if your doorbell rings and nobody's there. That was no Martian. It's Halloween.
Attention, everyone. This is an emergency broadcast. The unpleasant noise you are about to hear coming from your radio is not a mistake. Please do not turn off your radio, but turn up the volume on your receiver as high as it can go so that you can make the sound we broadcast as loud as possible.
Suddenly there was a threat to this world from some other species from another planet outside in the universe. We forget all of the local differences that we have between our countries. Perhaps we need some outside universal threat.
Controller, sir. Computer shows a discrepancy.
Why? Computer 5, what is the trouble?
We're checking.
All right. We change our plans. We begin the attack on Earth now.
That's Mix Master Mike with a track called Unidentified off his awesome record, Anti-Theft Device. And we're back now after that amazing entire episode of Hour of the Time with the late, great William Cooper examining the War of the Worlds and the Princeton Radio Project and Hollywood and the Pentagon and the OSS and the CIA and the CFR and on and on and on. So I hope you enjoyed that. And like I said, there is more to go over, dovetailing, of course, perfectly as we see the Blue Beam PSYOP prep still happening. Britain releases secret UFO files, this from the AFP. Britain's Ministry of Defense on Monday, October 20th, made public its secret files on UFO sightings, with the dossier including a range of reports from a close encounter with a UFO over Kent and a letter from a woman claiming to be an alien warrior. The 19 different incidents were recorded between 1986 and 1992 and published on the National Archives website. That would be at ufos.nationalarchives.gov.uk. There are thousands of UFO-related files, and as we move to the other piece from Danger Room, where they pull out one of the stories, one of the 19 stories, fighter jets ordered to shoot down UFO. At the height of the Cold War and hysteria about alien invasions, two U.S. fighter planes were, quote, scrambled in order to shoot down a UFO over the English countryside, end quote, Reuters reports. The incident is one of thousands of UFO-related files classified, or rather declassified, and released by the British government. I downloaded all 801 megabytes of the PDFs of the thousands of UFO-related files. In one document, F-86 pilot Milton Torres describes his encounter with a huge, erratically moving object in May 1957. Quote, "The order came to fire a full salvo of rockets at the UFO. To be quite candid, I almost shit my pants."
Visitors from another planet, or just tricks of the light? Exactly what was behind the latest batch of UFO sightings to be released will likely never be certain. But today the MOD's allowed us to take a look inside the real-life X-Files to see the evidence for ourselves. The National Archives website has unveiled documents detailing unidentified flying object sightings in the late 80s and early 90s. The most striking is the story of a passenger jet which had a near miss with the UFO as it came in to land at Heathrow in 1991. The captain of the Alitalia plane said he saw a brown missile-shaped object shoot overhead. He was so surprised he shouted, "Look out!" to his co-pilot. That sighting, like all of the 19 released today, was investigated but unsolved. The interest the files have sparked a measure, perhaps, of the UK's continuing fascination with the unexplained. Crop circles may have turned out to be a hoax, and Stonehenge may still be a mystery, but for some, these files just might have the clues to real life on other planets.
And again, you link over to nationalarchives.gov.uk. The flashback, of course, UK releases secret X-Files, this going back only to May of this year. So again, we see the blue beam psyop preparation. What form it will take is my fundamental question. Or will we all fall for it? What we're now going to move to, and what's going to clean us up here on the B-side as we play catch-up. Hopefully, as I note in the headline, in the posting, this is, and shall be, the shape of things to come. Citizens arrest attempt made on Karl Rove. So this was Tuesday, October 21st, from thinkprogress.org. During an event in San Francisco Tuesday morning, a protester tried to, quote, smack handcuffs on Karl Rove, but Rove slapped back and the woman was taken off stage. When Rove complained of negative campaign tactics by Democrats, his co-panelist, former Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell, quipped, quote, I have to say, I feel like Dorothy in the Land of Oz hearing you lecture about negative campaigns by others.
There was major political theater today involving President Bush's former chief of staff, or rather former chief advisor, Karl Rove.
A protester tried to arrest Rove for treason this morning while he was speaking at the Mortgage Bankers Association convention continuing in San Francisco.
ABC 7's Terry McSweeney is there live at Moscone West. And Terry, that was just part of the drama today.
Oh yeah, not just one protest, but three protests during this very lively, very exciting back and forth between former White House advisor Karl Rove and former Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell. Now, Rove, to no one's surprise, blaming the Democrats for everything wrong with the economy. That's to be expected. But here's something you've never seen before, the attempted arrest of Karl Rove.
Excuse me?
Why is there no woman up here?
You know,
we need a California woman up here. I am one. I'm Jeanine Bonaparte. I have to do an citizen's arrest. A citizen's arrest for treason.
A protester tries to slap the cuffs on Karl Rove, but Rove slaps back, and the woman is led away. Interesting theater. There was also this interesting observation from Karl Rove.
So the regulators in 2005 were the Republicans, the deregulators, the anti-regulators, the let-them-do-anything-they-want crowd were all Democrats, with all due respect.
There was a second protester, and then this pair of protesters, all were no longer there, for an exchange that brought down the House.
Yesterday, John Kerry, your nominee of your party in 2004, stands up and says, well, John McCain was asked the question of whether he wore boxer briefs. His answer would be, depends. I think that's pretty much under the table and pretty nasty.
I have to say I feel like Dorothy in the Land of Oz hearing you lecture about negative campaign by others.
Now, she shouldn't have done the intro. She should have just said, I'm making a citizen's arrest and gone for it. She talked too much and they had time to, of course, lead her away. So again, will we see more of that? I believe we shall. And as long as we're talking about complicit gangster scumbags, whether they're Bush's brain, like Karl Rove, supposedly, or they're a intelligence mouthpiece named Judith Miller. Again, from thinkprogress.org, Fox News hires disgraced reporter Judith Miller. Today, again being October 20th, The Washington Post's Howard Kurtz reveals that Fox News has hired former New York Times reporter Judith Miller, who will be an on-air analyst and write stories for Fox's website. She has a very impressive resume, says Senior Vice President John Moody. We've all had stories that didn't come out exactly as we'd hoped. It's certainly something she's going to be associated with for all time, and there's not much anyone can do about that, but we want to make the use of the tremendous expertise she brings on a lot of other issues. She has explained herself, and she has nothing to apologize for. Miller, however, had more problems than her stories not turning out exactly as she had hoped. Miller had been a willing participant in the Bush administration's quest to peddle lies to the American public. She was a key player in pushing false intelligence that led the public into the Iraq War and was central to the Valerie Plame leak scandal. On September 7th, 2002, she and fellow New York Times reporter Michael Gordon reported that Iraq had, quote, stepped up its quest for nuclear weapons and has embarked on a worldwide hunt for materials to make an atomic bomb, end quote. As proof, she cited unnamed, quote, American intelligence experts and unnamed Bush administration officials. Subsequently, Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, and Donald Rumsfeld all pointed to Miller's story as justification for war. On April 22, 2003, she told PBS's NewsHour that WMD had already been found in Iraq. Quote, well, I think they found something more than a smoking gun. In 2005, Judith Miller went to jail for refusing to testify in the Valerie Plame scandal and reveal her conversations with Scooter Libby. Miller was often criticized for becoming too close with her Bush administration sources. While she was in jail, for example, Libby wrote to her about how much he admired her and urged her to, quote, come back to work and life. As a reminder, as always, remember that Judith Miller was also a willing participant, along with CIA Director James Woolsey, in the Operation Dark Winter terror drill, which I have all five parts posted up on youtube.com/mediamonarchy. I just learned how to make a playlist out of them, so you can press one button and watch all five parts. I'm not sure if I mentioned, but thankfully, James Corbett at the Corbett Report, CorbettReport.com, pulled out one of the clips from Dark Winter. I think they deserve more attention than they get. And I, again, thank Killtown. That's who I grabbed the videos from in the first place. I just put them on YouTube in a more usable format. However, I digress, my friends. Let's move now to late, not so great, CIA black op old man expert E. Howard Hunt. Now E. Howard Hunt details JFK plot on never before seen video. This from Aaron Dykes at Infowars.com and JonesReport.com. In exclusive, never-before-seen footage, former CIA operative E. Howard Hunt discusses his knowledge of and participation in the plot to kill Kennedy in a video testimony he gave shortly before his death. Alex Jones's upcoming film will fully analyze the CIA shadow government coup that occurred inside the United States 45 years ago. Rolling Stone and a few other publications have covered Hunt's audio confession, released back in April 2007, but no one has yet seen the information the infamous White House plumber left behind to shed light on the figures involved in the plot. Here, Howard Hunt discusses LBJ, who saw Kennedy as an obstacle to the presidency. According to Hunt, LBJ consorted with top CIA officials Cord Meyer and William K. Harvey to carry out the plot.
Johnson, as we all know, was a very corrupt president.
Yeah.
Very capable of doing evil deeds, don't you think?
Unquestionably.
And if he wanted something done, he may have turned to someone like Bill Harvey,
right,
who was also extremely corrupt,
right,
and a psycho, basically.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I could just visualize Harvey and LBJ forming a kind of a thieves compact between them. Mm-hmm. But I think that LBJ was an opportunist, and if he not hesitated to get rid of obstacles in his way, I think his later career exemplified that. The vice president,
right,
had the most to gain.
Yeah.
And he was in a position where he could bring in people like Cord Meyer and others of interest, and get their take on different things, and then in turn issue instructions. There was nobody with the leverage that LBJ had, no competitor. He was the vice president, and if he wanted to get rid of the president, then he had the ability to do so by corrupting different people in the CIA. And he had to do it with the limitations of CIA, because there was no other group that honored, I could use that term, to honor the clandestine limitations the way CIA did. they could do something to turn their back on it and move on to something else. It was not like a military. There was no accounting in that sense. And we know that LBJ had an unlimited ambition. And we know that he was a corrupt individual. And that the dollar sign was very important to him. As vice president, he didn't have the leverage that a president did or would. And so that was an attractive goal for LBJ. He did not want his career to come to an end as vice president. Who knows about vice presidents? It was very, very important to him that he take advantage and to the extent that he could as vice president, because just a few things had to be accomplished. He had to kill Kennedy, have him killed, I should say, and be guilt-free himself. Then he could go on and do what he wanted to do as president of the United States.
Now let's turn to a quick biography of Cord Meyer. Cord Meyer Jr., born November 10th, 1920, died March 13th, 2001, was an American Central Intelligence Agency official. Meyer's father, Cord Meyer Sr., was a diplomat and former real estate developer. His grandfather, also called Cord Meyer, was a property developer and a chairman of the New York State Democratic Committee. He was educated at St. Paul's School, New Hampshire, and attended Yale University, where he was a member of the Scroll and Key Society. After graduating in 1942, he enlisted with the 22nd Marine Regiment and fought in the South Pacific. He fought in the Battle of Eniwetok and in the Battle of Guam as a platoon leader, losing his left eye in a grenade attack. He shared his war experiences writing for the Atlantic Monthly. In 1945, he married Mary Pinchot, P-I-N-C-H-O-T, daughter of Amos Pinchot. After the war, Cord Meyer Jr. was a strong advocate of world government. He was an aide of Harold Stason to the 1945 San Francisco UN Conference, and in 1947 was elected president of the United World Federalist, the organization he helped found. In 1959, Meyer's 9-year-old son Michael was hit by a car. He divorced his wife shortly thereafter. In 1964, she was shot dead by an unknown assailant alongside the Chesapeake and Ohio Canal, the C&O Canal. Around 1949, he started working for the CIA and joined the organization in 1951 at the invitation of Alan Dulles. Initially, he worked at the Office of Policy Coordination under former OSS man Frank Wisner. From 1954 until 1962, he was the head of the agency's International Organizations Division. He headed the covert action staff of the Directorate of Plans from 1962. From 67 to 73, he was Assistant Deputy Director of Plans under Thomas Karamessines. He retired in 77 after posting as Station Chief in London. In 1953, he came under attack by the FBI, who accused him of being a security risk for having once stood at the same podium of a notorious leftist and refused to give him the necessary security clearance. An internal CIA inquiry summarily dismissed the claims. According to Deborah Davis, Meyer became Operation Mockingbird's principal operative. And that comes from the book Catherine the Great by Deborah Davis from 1979 about Catherine Graham of the great Wurlitzer Washington Post. Meyer befriended James Jesus Angleton in the CIA. In 1964, Mary Meyer, Mary Pinchot Meyer, was shot dead. Her sister and brother-in-law, Benjamin C. Bradley, the later Washington Post executive, of course featured in All the President's Men, caught Angleton breaking into Pinchot's residence. Angleton apparently was looking for Mary Meyer's diary, which contained details of a love affair with John F. Kennedy. Meyer left the CIA in 77 and became a syndicated columnist. He also wrote several books, including an autobiography. He was long incorrectly considered by some to be Deep Throat. In a deathbed statement released in 2007, Watergate figure E. Howard Hunt states that Kordmeier Jr. organized the assassination of JFK at the behest of LBJ. The audio recordings also allege that, prior to the assassination, JFK had taken Meyer's wife as one of his mistresses. Kordmeier Jr. died of lymphoma on March 13, 2001. Finally, his famous last words, according to author C. David Heyman in the book The Georgetown Ladies Social Club from 2003. And it tells of Meyer's response when asked near the end of his life to comment on his wife's still unsolved murder case. Quoting from the book, Meyer held court at the beginning of February 2001, 6 weeks before his death, in the barren dining room of a Washington nursing home. Propped up in a chair, his glass eye bulging, he struggled to hold his head aloft. Although he was no longer able to read, the nurses supplied him with a daily copy of the Washington Post, which he carried with him wherever he went. Quote, My father died of a heart attack the same year Mary was killed, he whispered. It was a bad time. And what could he say about Mary Meyer? Who had committed such a heinous crime? He said, quote, The same sons of bitches that killed John F. Kennedy. Kordmeier Jr.'s supposed last words. A quick follow-up on these ignored new revelations from E. Howard Hunt. More deathbed confessions. Landmark Hunt confession videotape ignored. This from Paul Joseph Watson. The world exclusive E. Howard Hunt JFK confession videotape was released this week to a deafening silence from the mainstream media, while the dumbed-down general public attempted to dismiss the now-deceased whistleblower Hunt, a former CIA operative and Nixon White House insider, as a mentally unstable drunk. Dumbass comments on YouTube. E. Howard Hunt's deathbed confession needs to be treated with the gravity it deserves. It warrants widespread mainstream media attention, especially in the run-up to the 45th anniversary of the JFK assassination this coming November 22nd. Now, the two flashbacks there, Watergate plotter may have a last tale, is from March of 2007, and going back to January of 2007, when E. Howard Hunt died at the age of 88. Concluding on a non sequitur and relatively light note, given all that's come before. Finally, from Threat Level, anonymous member unmasked and charged with hacking on Scientology. An 18-year-old New Jersey man agreed to plead guilty to federal computer hacking charges Friday, October 17th. For participating in a denial-of-service attack against Church of Scientology websites as part of a collective of online troublemakers known as Anonymous. Dimitri Guzner, G-U-Z-N-E-R, is charged with a single felony count of unauthorized impairment of a protected computer for the January district... G-U-Z-N-E-R, Dimitri Guzner is charged with a single felony count of unauthorized impairment of a protected computer for the January distributed denial of service attack. He faces a likely sentence of 12 to 18 months in prison based on stipulations in his plea agreement, which also obliges him to pay $37,500 in restitution. Anonymous is best described as a collection of griefers who hang out in the net's most juvenile corners looking for some outlet for their boredom. Past targets, with a link for you, include uncool virtual worlds, an epilepsy message board, and a neo-Nazi webcaster. And there are long, bizarre comments that I don't quite get, but it at least concludes with, Miscavige, you're fooling no one. David Miscavige, the head of the cult of Scientology. My friends, thank you for joining me for this extra special B-side of episode 97 of MediaMonarchy.com. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster. And I'll be back with you very soon for episode 98 on Halloween. And the scariest thing I can think of is the perfect storm hat trick trifecta of the presidential selection 08, the economic New World Order financial breakdown, and the police state combat brigades at home. There's a lot to go over, and it's all going to be on episode 98 of MediaMonarchy.com. My name's James. Thanks for listening. I appreciate it. Like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
How would you explain it?
Combining music and stylized images.
It's all remote control.
Each one of those images was electronically based.
Say out on my threat.
And that concludes our program for tonight. Yo.
This could really catch on.
I can't remember when I've been so moved.